Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast, returning after the summer break. We're back with Assistant Professor Lewis de Freitas, historian of race and nation in the Anglophone world across the 19th and 20th century. Lewis's work has been published in the Journal of the Gilded Age in the Progressive Era, and he previously completed his PhD here at Cambridge before moving into a faculty position. Lewis was, of course, the previous host of this podcast, so it's been great having him on this time as a guest. Fergus Selsdon Games, a third-year PhD studying the intellectual afterlives of John Dewey, joins us too. Thanks to them both, and we hope you enjoy the episode. So, hello and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. We are here with Dr. Lewis de Freitas, who is going to be discussing his paper, which is called Neutrality by Absence, the Selective Repatriation of Americans at the Beginning of the First World War. Here as well with Fergus. So, Lewis, if you just want to introduce the paper, tell us about its contents, the argument, where we are in the world, what's going on, all that sort of thing. And also a special welcome, obviously, to Lewis, who was the previous steward of this podcast and is now on the other side of the microphone. So it's very good to have you here, and we're very grateful that you've taken the time.
Oh, spot on. Well, thanks, both of you, for having me. Really happy to be here. I like what you've done with the place. I like, you know, that portrait of me that's up on the wall, kind of like looking down on all of us. You know, it's kind of nice, to know that I'm being, you know, my legacy's carrying on.
Cemented.
No, but seriously, I'm very glad to be here. Where we are in the world is we're in July, August, September 1914, maybe even a little bit later in the case of Liberia. We're in Europe at the beginning of the First World War, and the article really is about Americans overseas who find themselves, to kind of one extent or another, stranded by the outbreak of the First World War as the kind of world's kind of transportation, financial systems kind of grind to a halt. Basically, where does that leave the tens to hundreds of thousands of American citizens who found themselves outside the boundaries of the United States? And the article, in the kind of first instance, looks at how the state responded to that problem, and it responded in a very direct way. It kind of sent ships across the Atlantic loaded with gold pieces to help, you know, basically pay for Americans' passage back to the United States. Then the kind of further east we move into the Ottoman Empire, and then further south into Liberia, that kind of becomes the process becomes a little bit more complicated. But the overall argument that I make is that this evacuation, this repatriation process, was both kind of a humanitarian effort to extract Americans from potential war zones, but it was also a kind of strategic and geopolitical and diplomatic effort to uphold American neutrality, basically by getting Americans out of kind of any areas of trouble, you know, get them out of danger, stop them from entangling the US further into a conflict that, frankly, it wanted nothing to do with in mid-1914.
I was wondering if we could know a little bit more about who the characters in the story really are. Who are these Americans gallivanting around Europe? What are they up to? What roles are they inhabiting?
Yeah, absolutely. So I start with a story that's probably like fairly familiar for people who know much about this period, that there's this kind of upper crust, so to speak, of American immigrants. There are businessmen. Herbert Hoover, the mining engineer, plays a big role in this, partly because he organises this relief mission. But you have like businessmen, you have socialites, you have people who have married into the European aristocracy in some senses. You have diplomats, but you also have like entertainers. I talk a little bit about an Anglo-American exposition that was in London at the time. This is a, you know, the kind of globalised world of early mass culture. People are, as you say, kind of gallivanting, moving back and forth, performing, kind of carrying with them ideas about America and going back with ideas about America. So that's the kind of upper crust, so to speak. There's also a kind of another couple of layers who aren't immediately evident, but the further this relief mission kind of travels through Europe and the further it kind of engages with European and American society, becomes more and more visible. So you have kind of itinerant workers, people who are classed as destitute, who are essentially kind of floating around from one job to the next. You have some porters. You have some kind of former mariners and sailors who find themselves in Europe. But you also have a lot of people who, at least my findings have shown, people who had moved to the United States, gained kind of naturalization as American citizens, and then returned back to Europe. People who wouldn't necessarily be immediately obvious as kind of Americans, so to speak, but when the proverbial hits the fan, are very quick to kind of claim that American status. Elsewhere we have the kind of other categories, things like missionaries and stuff, but that's kind of more of a issue in the Ottoman Empire and in Liberia than it is in continental and especially Western Europe.
Brilliant, yeah, thanks for that. So I'm an American in London, war's broken out, I'm reading the newspapers that I need to go back to the US. Where do I go? Who do I seek out? And how do I go about arranging safe passage?
Yes. So if you're in London, things were pretty easy. Things were pretty bad at first, but essentially what we have at the beginning of August, when war is declared, is a kind of logjam that navies are kind of requisitioning ships, basically calling them into service. Passenger liners are shutting down. The New York Stock Exchange shuts. It's very difficult to like cash a traveller's check. So if you're an American in London, who, you know, presumably you have a little bit of money, but essentially it's a logistical problem, what you do is you go to the Savoy Hotel, where there's a commission of American citizens in London. You might see future President Herbert Hoover sitting at a desk in the Savoy, who asks you about your financial situation. And depending on kind of how you're doing economically, they either advance you the funds to travel straight away or gives you some kind of credit for further travel. And then it's essentially a waiting game. If you're already in London, chances are they're going to try and find you passage on a ship. You might have to wait a week or two. You're kind of relying on the kindness of strangers, of maybe friends, kind of London socialites. There's all these stories in the paper about like members clubs hosting Americans, letting people sleep on their floor and stuff like that. So you go to the Savoy and then you kind of wait for someone to give you passage on a ship back and for that gold to come to the US. It becomes a bit more complicated in other instances, but I guess we'll get into that.
One of the things that's so interesting about the story is it's really about who's afforded the protection of the state and who isn't. And by extension, there's this running theme about citizenship, citizenships, and that category of analysis. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about citizenship in the context of this whole theme.
Yeah, totally. So people have been talking about citizenship in the United States kind of, you know, ever since the founding, but especially in the sort of 30 or 40 years preceding this, there's a lot of, as the kind of populace of the US changes, as immigration kind of diversifies, there's a lot of concerns really about who counts as an American citizen. And on one hand, you have a kind of process of naturalization where people who emigrate stay for about 5 years. That term, the kind of term of residence, keeps changing, but if you stay for 5 years, you gain naturalization, you get a certificate that basically says you're an American and you're entitled to all these types of protection, diplomatic protection, basically that the state's going to help you out when things go wrong. The issue is people who then get that naturalization status and then move back to Europe. And there is legislation that's passed in 1907, the Expatriation Act, which is kind of confirming and solidifying the kind of process by which those people would lose their kind of citizenship status. So the law is, if you, for instance, emigrate from Hungary, you go to the US, gain American citizenship, and then move back to Hungary. After, I think it's 3 years, you're supposed to lose your American citizenship. If you move to a different European country, it would be 5 years. But so those are the kind of terms under which you're supposed to lose your citizenship. What we find really in this period is that, first of all, like, that was very sloppily enforced. We're dealing with a kind of half-formed bureaucracy that can't really follow up on the kind of promises it's making, which then means that those people who should potentially be subject to expatriation are instead calling on the state to kind of help them in this time of crisis. So that's where the kind of boundaries of citizenship are deliberately blurred and where people kind of find openings and opportunities.
Yeah, so just kind of carrying on in that vein, obviously some people would be dual citizens at this time. So how would fears about, say, German subversion enter the thinking about of government officials? Does in turn this evacuation bring to the fore nascent concerns about national security that would rise to prominence over the century? Is this an early window into the expansion of a national security state?
Yeah, cool. So at the time, the thing that people are writing about isn't so much surveillance, but worries about dual citizens being conscripted. So especially in countries that have kind of active, you know, conscription and impressment of people into the armed forces, there are worries in the State Department that people with those kind of dual citizenships would then find themselves kind of conscripted into for instance, the German military. That's the worry, basically, that the US doesn't want to have to worry to deal with that, so they try to get people out. Increasingly, though, like over time, as people write about their experiences during this period, you do see a kind of emergence of people worrying about potential German surveillance, especially after the US enters the war in 1917. There's the whole kind of like spies and lies campaign and the kind of fiasco about German espionage. And you do see especially like diplomatic and consular officials who write their memoirs like, you know, in their 20s or 30s at the kind of after this nativism has been sort of enshrined in legislation, there are right about this episode kind of with the sense of there were probably some people who slipped through the net and might have even kind of undermined national security. That's not a concern that I see at the time, but it's one that I think people are pretty eager to kind of reflect backwards onto this period, because as I say, it's not very well kind of, the documentation's not very well kept. There's not actually, you know, that much of an apparatus there for surveillance and kind of catching people out, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of follow on, it really feels like they just let everybody in. Like, they're really working hard to get people back at the expense of, like, rigorous analysis of who those people are. So do you think it is kind of a wake-up call about how little the country knows and the kind of mechanisms it's using to adjudicate who is allowed into its borders?
Yeah, some people definitely think that at the time, actually. I should have said, the American ambassador in Britain is pretty concerned about what he sees as people kind of, like, fraudulently claiming American citizenship. At the time, at least, and this is gets us onto the question of archives, his concerns don't really seem to be heeded or really like given much credence in DC. The State Department aren't that bothered about it. I guess that this guy, Walter Hines Page, would see himself as like, you know, he's had a personal wake-up call. The way I see it is it's kind of takes a while for that really to enter the public discourse. But as I say, the concern was about just getting Americans out and removing any kind of threat of further entanglement in the war effort. Some people who aren't American citizens, and like definitely aren't American citizens, are helped. People under American colonial rule, Filipinos and Puerto Ricans, who are definitely, by definition, legally not American citizens, are extended the kind of protection to the state during this period, precisely because the US kind of has charge of these people and just wants to get them out of the danger zone.
Yeah, and then by extension, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, there must be some people who don't just slip through the cracks but actually get rejected. Again, it's the question about archival silences and which stories you can and can't trace. Do you have a sense from your research about who will have been turned away completely?
Yeah, I don't have a huge sense of it at the moment. I know people were turned away, especially in London. It sounds like on the continent itself, consuls and kind of this US relief commission that goes out into Europe are essentially able to render help to anyone who needs it and requests it. The kind of next stage of screening, though, is that most of these transatlantic voyages are taking off from England. So it's once people get from the continent into Britain that there's more of a kind of screening process. And there, I think, there is an attempt to screen out people who, at the very least, didn't have American citizenship. Hines Page writes about people who he thinks weren't even previously resident in the US, like they weren't even kind of previous immigrants in any sense. The problem with the limits of the archive, though, is that I don't yet have a sense of how that screening happened or how many people were kind of filtered out at each wave. You can kind of read that there is a little bit of that happening, that people are getting turned away, but it sounds like a lot of it is kind of imprecise. It comes down to the eye test, down to people's own kind of like prejudices on to as regards to like who looked like, sounded like, acted like an American. So that was definitely there, but I'm not quite sure just yet how that functioned in practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so far we've kind of been with the Allies, comfortable ground, Europe, England, going back to America. What's going on in the further reaches of the continent? You talk a bit about the Ottoman Empire, particularly an incident where that empire fired warning shots at an American ship. Can you explain what was going on there, how it happened, and the kind of significance of those events?
Yeah, so this gets me, I suppose, to one of the secondary arguments and the kind of like a meta argument of the article, is that a lot of what happened in 1914 was dependent on and interacting with kind of the last two or three decades of US globalization, the expansion of American power. It's not all just about kind of what happens after the First World War. And in the Ottoman Empire, we have a kind of very clear example in that the Ottomans had been subject to kind of surveillance to American ships sailing into Ottoman waters in the 1890s, around the time of the first killings of, like, mass killings of Armenians, American ships sailing to Ottoman waters to kind of keep an eye on the situation. They don't intervene, but they do, like, face a lot of kind of disapproval and disavowal from diplomats. That happens again during one of the Balkan Wars, I think around 1910 and 1912. So there's already a kind of discontent, kind of like dissatisfactions at American ships sailing into those waters. And in September, as these ships, the USS Tennessee and the USS North Carolina, like, sail further east, they run into those same troubles again. By this point, the Ottoman Empire hadn't joined the Central Powers, but did protest and had, like, ruled that foreign ships couldn't sail into its waters. And it fires these warning shots at the Tennessee just off the coast of Smyrna, modern-day Izmir. It claims that it's doing so because it's trying to warn these ships that the port is mined and it doesn't want it kind of to face further kind of damages. It doesn't want to, like, there to be a real catastrophe on hand. But really what's happening and what the State Department says is happening is that they're having these warning shots fired so that they don't dock and kind of enter Ottoman territory. Basically, they just don't want anyone in at the time. And it's partly of that kind of escalation towards their intervention in the conflict.
Right. And then stepping back and in a broader sense, what do you see as the wider resonances of this story?
Yeah, the wider resonances. I think part of it is, again, to show the kind of the types of American engagement with the world prior to the First World War. Like, it's, there's sort of an argument I make in the paper that you can only really see how things work when they go wrong. And this is partly about that, whether it's missionaries.
The crash test.
Yeah, exactly. The crash test. That's exactly it. Whether it's kind of like missionaries or the kind of like different layers of migration and return migration. And even into, yeah, Liberia, which we've not talked about yet, but the kind of like settlement and the back and forth there. I do think there's a resonance here, though, both in terms of kind of it being a kind of origin point for these mass evacuations. You see a similar one during World War II, and there's other ones. There's a kind of the non-combatant evacuation operation, which is more of commonplace in the 21st century. But the final kind of broader bit of significance, and I'm still kind of sketching this out in my head, so it's going to sound even worse in speech, is that this is a sort of pivot point in the broader relationship between the American state and its overseas citizens. That in the late 19th century, during this period of like imperial expansion and the kind of growth of American power, in not all cases, but in a lot of cases, American citizens, businessmen, missionaries kind of served to further American foreign policy objectives by their kind of presence and activities overseas. Hawaii is obviously a kind of classic example, but there's similar things going on in the Caribbean and even in Europe. Here in 1914, though, we see the kind of first major widespread incident where that kind of presence is actually actively kind of getting in the way of, actively kind of conflicting with American foreign policy aims. And I would suggest, and this is really tentative, that this sort of continues to be the case later in the 20th century. Even as American power expands, even as the US kind of grows as a superpower, it becomes less reliant on the kind of prior activities of its private citizens and becomes kind of more inclined to see what people are doing around the world as an inconvenience rather than a foot in the door, so to speak.
Yeah, so I kind of want to follow on from this. I haven't fully formulated this question,
no
so
worries.
Please. But what I kind of enjoyed about it was that the story of a lot of American historiography is people coming to America, and you're doing the opposite thing, which is people leaving in America. And being in Europe and enmeshed in the old world in a kind of different way to how we basically typically imagine. Are you going to be speaking, if you do situate this in a broader project, which I think this is, about Americans in Europe rather than Europeans in America, which is so kind of central to a lot of American historiography?
Yes, that was a great question. I'm glad you asked it, partly because it gives me a chance to talk about like my PhD work, which is what this directly grows out of. That, like, my initial interest was not so much in these kind of moments of crisis, but in terms of how Americans used Europe and Britain specifically to kind of understand their own kind of sense of nationality and like their race and their place within the American polity. I'm still working on that project, which really goes up to 1914, and this is at least initially was like a way of looking at how that kind of network was disrupted. But I could see this hopefully maybe developing into a second project, which is more about those moments of crisis. But I do see it kind of situated within that broader field of sort of America in the world and kind of American citizens in the world. I'm thinking especially about like Steve Tuffnell's work on American immigrants in Britain, or maybe even more relevantly, Brooke Blower's work. She wrote, first of all, a book about Americans in Paris during the interwar period, but then has recently released a book about Americans in a world at war, like around the world during the kind of prelude to and during the Second World War. So there's clearly a kind of connection there in terms of how people think first about the sort of cultural landscape and trying to bring out the kind of depth and complexity of all things like that, but then about, again, these moments of crisis and where people who were, like, you know, non-state actors, so to speak, like most of the people I look at are so non-state that they don't even think of themselves as non-state actors. They kind of want nothing to do with it, suddenly having to engage with this bureaucratic apparatus and stuff. So yeah, it will form part of a broader project, but it's about trying to, I suppose I want to think more about that relationship between like peacetime and wartime.
Mm-hmm. Quick fire.
Yeah.
Lewis, what was the coolest act performed at the White City Anglo-American Exposition?
Yeah, so you've got so I talk a little bit about this Wild West show, but the coolest thing was the Jenkins Orphanage Band, which was this group of ragtime musicians from an orphanage in Charleston, South Carolina, who are like all African-American young kids, wore military uniforms and played like kind of ragtime early jazz music in London, and they were a bit of a hit. They were going to tour Europe and then had to cancel their plans.
Should have released a single.
Should
have. Do you have a favourite book about World War One?
My favourite book about World War One. I've really like, I know it's sort of a kind of classic one, but I really like that David Kennedy one. Is it Over Here? The one about wartime and American society.
What does shilly shallying mean?
I think it's, yeah, I wasn't sure about that. You can tell I put that in because it's a funny word.
It is a great word.
I think it's kind of dawdling, I would describe it as kind of procrastinating, as, you know, sitting on their thumbs, so to speak.
That was what I understood in context.
Good.
What was the last album you listened to?
Last album that I listened to,
and I
was,
have to ask this because I know you used to ask it to people.
My last album I listened to was Double Nickels on the Dime by Minutemen, which I listened to on my way into work this morning.
This is mean. What was the sixth of Wilson's 14 points?
Oh, I've no idea. I've absolutely no idea.
And lastly then, as a veteran of the forum, what makes a great podcast?
I think, you know, an openness on both part of interviewer and interviewee, and you know, a willingness to make like kind of complex historical work open and accessible and sometimes even fun for the listener. And I think you're both doing a really good job of that here. And it's,
thanks, Lewis.
Yeah.
I'd also add professional production.
And professional production, yes, of course.
Which you've just witnessed. On that note, thank you very much, Lewis, for coming in. It's been good to see you. And it was an excellent seminar yesterday.
It was indeed. And we'll have you back sometime.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Cheers. Thanks.
And that was Lewis de Freitas and Fergus Estrie. We hope you enjoyed, and do be on the lookout for more episodes soon. There will be new hosts and a great lineup of speakers over the course of this year. Cheers, stay well.